and Chris, and this is my Writing Table podcast, where we talk to authors and other creatives about the writing world and what it takes to create the books that we love to read. Ready? Pull up a chair and let's begin. Jeff Hoffman quit a perfectly good job at the age of 47 to return to college for his MFA. And his first novel, Other People's Children, emerged from that silly decision. In addition to his two novels, Jeff's writing has been published in The Sun, Booth, Harper, Palette, and Publishers Weekly. He was the winner of the Madison Review's Chris O'Malley Prize in Fiction and a finalist for the Missouri Review's Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize. He is a passionate proponent of the Oxford comma, a mediocre men's league hockey player, and a fair-weather fan of the Chicago Blackhawks. He was born and raised in St. Louis and now lives in Elmhurst, Illinois, with his wife and two children. His second novel is Like It Never Happened. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great. You have to ask, what possessed you, what inspired you to quit your job and pursue an MFA?
Yeah, there's a fine line between inspiration and possession, right?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
I had always been a reader, and ever since I was a kid, and I had taken some time, when I was 30, and when my wife and I adopted our children, and at that time I took some time off work and wrote a book, and it was horrible, and went in the drawer. It's that first novel. And then when I was in my mid-40s, I think I was 47 when I quit my job and decided to, I always wanted to write a novel, and always isn't going to last forever, right? And you start to realize that at my age. And so I went back to school and got my MFA from Columbia College Chicago. It was a great experience and allowed me to kind of dive into learning again that I hadn't, in a way that I hadn't done in so long. And resulted in my first novel coming out the other end.
I have to tell you, I quit my job at 46 to write full time, but just sometimes it takes us a while.
It's something that I always wanted to do. I'm a bit of a one tracker, right? That I can't. I'm not one of those people that can get up early, and I'm not Toni Morrison, right? Where I can have a full time job and be taking care of the kids, and then get up at 4 in the morning and write 1500 words, right? I really needed to focus on it in order to do well.
Well, we're glad you got here.
Well, thanks.
Your debut novel, Other People's Children, received rave reviews from Laura Dave, Midwest Book Review, Publishers Weekly, many others. What made you write a story of family for your debut?
I think that families are, being a father is central to who I am, right? That's part of it. And family, for me, some of my favorite books center on family and the stories that are woven into family dynamics and family relationships are always interest me. I also have two adopted children. So it was a book that centered on adoption. And, it was also a book about, expectations and how expectations don't always aren't always matched by the realities of your life, right? And different people react to those things in different ways. And by the time I was 47, it happens to everybody, right? That the way that your life unfolds doesn't match the expectations that you had for it. And, teasing apart how that manifests itself in different characters and different stories and in different people was something that interested me quite a bit.
Well, I've heard that expectations are kind of setups for us. They the way we write the story in our head of how it's supposed to be, and then God says, ha ha ha, want to laugh?
I wouldn't have it any other way, right? My family is my family, and I love them, and I'm that's who I am as a dad, right? But my daughter has special needs that affects everyone in our family and affects us all in different ways. And it's really important to be able to adjust, right? And to say, that's what I thought my life was going to be like, but now I'm going to value the life that's been given to me and sink into that experience in the same way that I thought I might have sunk into a different one.
Well, your next novel is Like It Never Happened, and it's steeped in relational tension and secrets. Tell us about it.
I will. Thank you for asking. It centers on four boys who they get in a fight in a Burger King parking lot when they're 18, right, with two other boys, and they kill one of them and they incapacitate the other. And that's a bit of a spoiler. But these four boys, they get away with the crime, but their relationship shatters when this in the aftermath of it, as they decide what to do. And they don't see each other for about 30 more years until one of them dies. And they meet up again at the friend's funeral, and they meet the wife of the dead man, who is a reporter and knows the whole story and is determined to hold them accountable. And for me, it was really that crime, it drives the plot forward, and it's kind of the central pole in the tent, right? The really interesting grist for the mill for me is how that secret and how the lies and that lack of accountability, how that's kind of eroded the relationships and put some rot into the lives and the families of each of those individuals. And more importantly, as they're held accountable and as they, choose and fits and starts to hold themselves accountable, how that helps to repair those relationships or not. Right. And that's where the tension of the book, where the center of the book is for me, is in those, what happens in each of those individual men's families.
Oh, interesting. Sarah Lynn Bruck just came out with a book in January, kind of a similar theme where she had these three friends and something happens and those secrets are, like you said, that's the grist. You put a good secret between friends, and man, as a writer, there's a lot you can do with that. And it sounds like you've really maximized that with this story.
And it's a question of who knows what. And I think one thing that I wrote from the point of view of the men's wives as well. And so there's actually seven points of view in the book. And what was interesting to me is how the women in their lives, the ones, one of their wives knew because she was a girlfriend in high school, right? But the others didn't. And it was interesting to play with the idea of, what did they feel in their relationships? What holes did they feel in the relationships that were caused by the thing that secret they didn't even know about? And it was interesting to explore it from the opposite side as well.
I'm picturing one hell of a Venn diagram you must have had to draw to write this novel. Who knew what? Who didn't know? What does it mean? One of the questions I was going to ask you, actually, and I'm glad you brought up the seven points of view. I didn't realize you had seven, but with the varying perspectives and characters, how did you decide how to piece it all together?
I spent a lot of time thinking about point of view. I've tried writing from, first person or a single point of view, and I just feel so constrained, right? I want to know what's going on in the minds of all those other characters, right? For me, it builds tension, the multiple points of view. You can leave a scene with a character in crisis and then move to another character's point of view, and that crisis can't be resolved because you're on a different stage, right? And that that builds suspense, builds tension into the story. But it also, I think, seeing things from different perspectives allows you to really play with the different interpretations of the same event, right? What really happened, and what disconnects do all these men have about what happened in that parking lot so long ago, and what happened afterwards? But then, when it comes time to choose whose point of view is going to be represented in a particular scene, when you have two main characters on stage, for me, it always comes down to who changes the most, who's going to experience, the most change from the beginning of that. And even if it's, 2000 words, right, from the beginning of those 2000 words to the end. And I want to be in the head of the person that experiences that change. I've learned not to, give everybody the same amount of time, right? Every character has to earn their own scenes, driving the story forward with, each person, pushing their part of the plot forward is really exciting for me, and is some of the most fun that I have. And, giving them their own voice too, is exciting, not only in the dialogue, but in the way they think. That was the thing I've spent a lot of time on over the last few years is honing that internal dialogue, so that the paragraph in the middle of that chapter from a particular point of view could only belong to that character.
you have to write a story before you really do understand what is the currency for each character. What is it? Because some things are catastrophic for one, and another character would react like, yeah, no big deal. But you don't know that until you get the bones of the novel down. That's my process. And I know everybody does it differently. How did that work for you?
You know, I started with, you know, what happened in the parking lot. And I started with a sketch of the, you know, each of these four men and their wives. And from there, it was, let's see what happens. I knew I was going to start with, you know, the obituary, right? From there, it was exploration, right? I write with a pen and paper. I can't start on the computer. I have to start with my notebook. Just follow the characters. And I learn who the characters are. And then I follow them. And then that tells me where they're going. And it's a very iterative process and very inefficient process. But I wish I was an outliner. You know, I wish I was one of those people that could just show up and say, well, here's the 18 beats and here's where they're going to happen. But, you know, that's what I do in the rewriting is, you know, build that story structure into it in the rewriting after I know what it's about, after I know who the characters are, and after I know the bones of the plot, then I shape it and rewrite it. I'd be writing a lot more books if I did it the other way, I guess.
Outlining works for some people. And again, you've got to do what works for you. What I found is it was very restrictive. It closed me off creatively. Like I must adhere to this outline. And I was watching James Patterson's masterclass. I used his version of outlining for this novel I'm working on now. Basically, he writes the bones of the novel. He says chapter one's this is the paragraph for everything. And then that's your outline and you go with it. And of course, it's going to change after you write it. But I found that to work a little better. Kind of like the surprise of like, guess what happened today? I didn't even know this.
Yeah, I feel a little bit more like a job if I had to follow the outline, right? You know, let's get the Gantt chart out and you know, run this project, right? I'd much rather, you know, learn who my characters are and where they're going to lead me. It sounds a little frou-frou, but you know, it's the reality of how I write and how I've drifted into the novels that I've written.
There are things that we can pick out of books and people will say, where'd this come from? Not a clue. It's something magic out there that our brains pick up. And I don't think that outlining really lets that happen.
Yeah. Carl Jung probably has some thoughts about that, but Campbell, but I don't know if it's like this for you, but it's really exciting. You know, the plot points and the story that's all fun when that occurs, but when, and it doesn't always happen, right? Sometimes you really have to fight to learn who your character is. But when you write that, when with certain characters, I've written that first chapter from their point of view, and they just fell onto the page. And and I didn't know who they were before I started writing. And, you know, 1,500, 2,000 words later, I'm like, that's who Carly is, or that's who Tommy is. And
cool.
And that's just a wonderful way to meet a character and makes it all worthwhile when you're able to do that. But and that's all, it's all coming from the subconscious because it's not coming from a character sketch or
research or yeah. It's, you know, when I was in graduate school in gender comm, one of my professors, Dr. Hansen, talked about standpoint theory and everything that we are is everywhere we've been up to this point in time. That is something that cannot be replicated. Somebody could do all the same things, but it's never going to be the same. We can write a novel that from the back copy looks like it might be the same novel, but it's not going to be. It's going to be totally different.
Mystic River maybe feels a little like my novel from the jacket cover, right? But you know, it's every writer brings what they bring to the table and every reader brings what they bring to the table too.
Exactly. Did you end up doing third person close on this?
Third person close. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll bet that is fun to get to see kind of, you get to be God and the person see it all.
I try not to be God, you know, and I actually played a little bit with, you know, because when these men come back together, they had such a tight relationship. And there's certain scenes where where I allow the point of view to shift mid-scene, even, you know, mid-paragraph from person to person, because as they regain their relationship, as they regain their friendship, I try to allow that to appear through the way that the point of view lands on the page during a few chapters. And that was kind of fun too. I've really worked a lot on how to find my way into that interiority of the each character. And, you know, it's, I need to know, like, what's completely separate from the plot, completely separate from what they want associated with, you know, escaping the secret or embracing the accountability or whatever it is. You know, what is it that drives them, right? You know, Tommy is a building engineer, and so his interiority is littered with words like weight and plumb and, you know, gears that don't quite mesh. Malcolm is he's kind of closed himself off and has become a corporate mergers and acquisitions lawyer. And so everything is about leverage and negotiation with Malcolm. And these aren't just, you know, what they consciously think about, but it's how they unconsciously, you know, unspool their thoughts when they're digesting a problem or a situation.
When you turned this novel into your editor, how much did it change? Picturing seven points of view.
There were a lot of changes along the way. I would say that my agent pushed me in certain ways. Editor read it and she purchased it, right? But then before she went back and did her editing work, I luckily had 2 or 3 months to reread it and rewrite it 3 more times. And
3 more times.
And it was one thing that was really great was that she came to it and I, you know, she was busy with other projects. And so I gave her the revised work and she said, I don't remember that. I like this better. And so my editor did a great job. She definitely made the novel better and helped me tighten things up and helped me, you know, kind of cinch some of the saggy parts. It was relatively painless.
When you look back at your MFA, what are a few of the lessons that you most treasure that pop up when you're drafting?
So I loved the MFA experience. It was kind of weird. You know, I'm coming back as an almost 50-year-old with in a cohort with mainly, you know, 20 to 30-year-olds, right? So that was an experience that probably deserves a novel of its own, right? But I spent so much more time and effort in, you know, just in a single class, I probably spent more effort than I did an entire year in my undergrad, right? Where I was just trying to get the A and trying to get graduated, right? And trying to get to the bar on time. I really sunk into it and I enjoyed the reading and really reading from a craft perspective. I had a professor who his thing was always, what's the shape of this novel? If we had to put it into geometric shapes, what shape does this novel take? And understanding how different novels stack up in those ways and other professors who, you know, helped me understand where I was leaving characters flat or was so just the immersion in writing and reading and writing and reading. That I treated it like a job, right? I knew at 47 that I, you know, like this is my shot to write a novel, right? I'm gonna give this 2 or 3 years, and then I'm gonna go back and get a job. And if I don't make a go of this, and so I put 50 hours a week into it. And the big thing I learned was, you know, nose to the grindstone, right? You know, to get as many of the 10,000 hours that you can get tucked away into this. This slice of time, take all the feedback that you can get from that 25-year-old that you have nothing in common with in your cohort. You know what? She is a reader and she has read your work and she is reacting to a way that's authentic and is useful, and pay attention to that.
When you're writing and you're maybe in a little bit of a rut or you just like, it's just not working for me today. What is your go-to? You know, I call it like your creative purgatory. You're kind of parked for a little bit. Yeah. What is it that you can depend on? If I do this, I'm going to find that inspiration.
When I'm writing, I keep writing. And there have been days when I just scribble in the notebook for you know, 3 hours or 4 hours, and nothing gets resolved, and then I go away about my life, right? And I find that those 4 hours are really important, but then the rest of my life is really important too. I think one of the things that I've learned from writing is how to pay attention to the rest of my life, right? And, you know, whether that's playing hockey or going sailing or you know, riding my bike in the woods or whatever it is, or, you know, just hanging out with friends or spending time with my kids and my wife and paying attention. I would call it a virtuous cycle, right? Paying attention mm-hmm. to how people act in real life, mm-hmm. you're a better writer, right? You know, mm-hmm. Everybody thinks about writing as this solitary experience, and it is, right? You spend those 4 to 6 hours in your room and you do your work, but then it is fed by those experiences that are outside of that room. And without those experiences outside of that room, then the writing falls flat. And if you don't pay attention to the rest of your life, it's hard to breathe real life into your characters. It's a cycle that feeds. Paying attention more to my life mm-hmm. makes my life better too. Being a writer, you know, helps me, you know, stay in the moment in ways that I don't think I did as well before I wrote as much as I do now.
You can't sell what you haven't written. Clock's ticking. I've got to get this done. And so then you go, I don't have time for my outside real life. But then when it's not happening in here and you go out to your outside real life, that's when your brain goes, hey, it seems counterproductive, but there really is some discipline required to be able to disconnect from the writing and go into your real life. And I think that's something that they don't teach us, but it's really hard to do that.
I looked at a couple different schools, and one of them was the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. And I was being interviewed or, you know, having a discussion with one of the professors there on one of the exploration days. And, you know, I was talking about how excited I was to, you know, to set this time aside in my life to write. And it stuck with me because she made a point of it. She was a very quiet person. She was one of those people that said few sentences. So when she said them, you listen to them. And she said, make sure you walk too. Right.
Wow.
And she said a few more words to, you know, understand what she meant. But it's like, don't let writing consume because mm-hmm. writing is fed by the rest of your life. Make sure that you're living in ways that are authentic and genuine and full, because that'll make you a better writer and that'll certainly make you a happier person too, right?
Amen.
I never saw that person again. I forget what her name was, but you know, I think about that sentence that she fed me. I think about it on a monthly basis that, whatever you're pursuing, writing or otherwise, you need to make sure it's fed by the things that bring you joy.
To learn more, visit jeffhoffmanwrites.com.
If you're enjoying The Writing Table, please consider leaving us a review. There are so many podcasts out there. Reviews help other listeners find us. Thanks so much for your support.